Are we already living in the Chinese century? In the epic geopolitical struggle of our age, does Beijing already have the upper hand? During the Cold War, the Soviet Union had a population to rival the United States, but not the economic system. In the 1980s and early 1990s, Japan had the economic system, but not the population. China has both. And our next guest also believes it has a key competitive advantage. Its elite is dominated by engineers, while America's is dominated by lawyers. We're witnessing a tussle between an engineering society and a lawyerly society. Dan Wong is the author of a new book called Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future. Dan Wong, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much, Nick.
You've come up with a novel way of framing the US-China rivalry. China is best understood as an engineering country, and America is best understood as a lawyerly country. First of all, give us a sense of how engineers tend to rise to the top in China.
Ever since Deng Xiaoping took over from the wreckage of the Mao years in the late 1970s, Deng Xiaoping asked, what is Mao Zedong fundamentally? Mao was a poet, a romantic, and a warlord, and he left communist China at the late 70s in complete ruins. And Deng Xiaoping asked himself, what is the complete opposite of a poet? Well, surely it is an engineer. Who could be more boring and technocratic than that? And so what Deng Xiaoping ended up doing was promoting engineers, people trained in very much the Soviet style of engineering, into the top ranks of China's leadership, such that by the year 2002, all nine members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, highest ruling echelon in the Communist Party, all of them were trained in engineering. The general secretary was trained as a hydraulic engineer. The premier was a geologist, and on and on. And what all of that has meant is that China, I think, treats a lot of the physical environment as an engineering exercise. It's really built so many astonishing masses of roads, bridges, coal, solar, nuclear, homes, etc. There are also economic engineers really trying to engineer the property bubble away, or try to push young people away into strategic sectors of the economy like semiconductors and aviation, and away from cryptocurrencies or the consumer internet. They're also fundamentally social engineers, engineers of the human soul.
Well, that's something I want to get to later. The social engineering is as important as the civil engineering. And by contrast, you make the point that America's political leadership is dominated by people who went to law school.
Before there was any law schools, there were plenty of American lawyers. If we take a look at the first 16 U.S. presidents, everyone from George Washington to Abraham Lincoln, 13 of them were trained as lawyers at some point. The Declaration of Independence really reads like the start of a legal complaint. And the Democratic Party in particular, in the modern day, is especially lawyerly. From 1980 to 2024, every single nominee to be president among the Democrats had gone to law school. It's a remarkable concentration of a certain type of training. And I think what is remarkable about the U.S. is that I think lawyers are much better at stopping things than actually building things. And so what that means is that the U.S. doesn't have stupid ideas like the one-child policy. It also doesn't have functional infrastructure almost anywhere across the country.
Well, let's get onto that at a moment. But I wonder how Donald Trump fits within this rubric. He's not a lawyer. He's been surrounded by lawyers a lot of his life. He's a very litigious president. I mean, how does Donald Trump fit into your kind of frame about the domination of people related to law at the top of the country?
You're right that Donald Trump did not go to law school, but you're also right that Donald Trump is a very litigious individual. And I think we cannot understand the business career of Donald Trump without seeing how central lawsuits are throughout his entire business life. This man has sued everyone. He has sued his former business partners. He has sued his political opponents. He sued the BBC. And after this interview, maybe he'll sue the ABC as well. What do you think, Nick? How about that?
Well, let's hope not, but you never know.
And there is something very accusational about him, in which he is intimidating people and flinging accusations left and right and trying to establish guilt in the court of public opinion. So I would say that Donald Trump is still a product of the lawyerly society.
Let's talk about how these lawyerly and these engineering countries contrast and what that actually looks like. You spent time in China. You spent years living in China. In the book, you describe going on bike trips through China, and you were astonished that even China's poorest provinces have this extraordinary infrastructure. Dan, paint us a picture of those bike rides.
Let me tell you about the summer of 2021, when I was living in China's greatest city, Shanghai, really wonderful place. And what I decided to do in the middle of the zero COVID policy was to scare up two friends with me to go into the countryside. And where the three of us went was deep in the southwestern mountains in a province called Guizhou, which is heavily mountainous, far away from the prosperous coasts. It is China's fourth poorest province and hasn't really caught too much of the economic boom. And what we discovered over 5 days of cycling through Guizhou was a much, much better level of infrastructure than anywhere in the US. I spent a lot of time in New York State, which is where I went to university. I'm also a fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. California and New York are two of the richest economic entities in the world. Neither of these places have very functional infrastructure, not much by way of high-speed rail, and not very well connected. Guizhou, by contrast, has about 15 airports. It has 50 of the world's tallest bridges in the world. Not China's tallest bridges, but the world's tallest bridges. And also, it has high-speed rail connections. And so this is where I really came into a glimpse of socialism with Chinese characteristics, where the party has decided it's not going to give money directly to the people. It is rather stingy with the amount of money it gives. Rather, it's just going to build them a really tall bridge and make them love it.
But Dan, doesn't that point to a problem in China right now, which is a problem of over-engineering? I mean, a lot of these places do not need these massive bridges. In a lot of these places, these bridges don't have much traffic. And the problem with building these bridges is they've created this huge debt burden for so many of these Chinese provinces.
I agree with you, but let me try to make the case from the perspective of a villager that they really do want some of these bridges. Now, a lot of these bridges are indeed uneconomical, and we can see that there is a very high debt burden among a lot of these local government entities in Guizhou province. But tell a villager who's now able to get into the city for the first time, we're taking away your bridge, you don't really need it. And I think that that villager will have something to say about that. And state media is always very keen to about how it has reduced travel times from 3 to 3, something like 3 hours to 3 minutes to cross this big valley. And that is, I think, legitimate and real as well. Now, I think it is the case that traffic is not very high, but hey, traffic is a bad thing anyway. So the less traffic, maybe the better.
Well, it's interesting you brought up travel times, because I think one of the fascinating bits in your book is where you actually contrast some of the travel times for the US rail network in the 21st century with the travel times in the 19th century. And it's not good.
It's not good. Let me tell you about travel times in the lawyerly society. 2 months ago, I took the train from New York City to Washington, D.C. to speak at the Abundance Conference. This is America's pitiful answer to high-speed rail. It's called the Accela Network. And Accela is reasonably okay. It is a very shaky train, but it has been getting slower over time. The homeowners have around the tracks have really put up a lot of litigation that makes the tracks much more curvy than it needed to be. Now, I wrote this book substantially as a fellow at the Yale Law School, when I was occasionally taking the train from New Haven, Connecticut down to New York City, which takes about 2 hours. And that train system works relatively well. But I was really radicalized in my political beliefs once I came across a train timetable from the year 1914, when I discovered that it took slightly less time to travel from Yale University to New York City about 100 years ago than it does in the present moment. So, you know, at a first approximation, we are moving slower and slower year by year, century by century. Not good.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time on the Accela over the years, and you can get an awful lot of work done because the journey times are so slow. Now, Dan, you make the point in the book that America did used to be an engineering society. In fact, from 1850 to around 1950, it was the workshop of the world, starting perhaps with the opening of the Brooklyn Bridge, which was the moonshot of its day. If you wanted to see mammoth infrastructure projects, you went to the United States. When did the engineering impulse get superseded or even crushed by the loyalty mindset?
crushed, superseded, strangled by the lawyers. I think that really began in the 1960s. And in the century before the 1960s, America used to build these fantastic projects, not only the Brooklyn Bridge, but skyscrapers in Chicago, as well as Manhattan, rail systems, the interstate highway system, the Erie Canal system. And they also built the Manhattan Project, as well as the Apollo missions. These are examples of the technological sublime. But the United States certainly did overbuild. And what we saw in the U.S. was that throughout the 1950s, essentially, urban planners like Robert Moses overran a lot of important city neighborhoods with too many highway projects. We had the Department of Agriculture spray too much DDT and other pesticides throughout the entire country. There were just too many examples of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers damming essentially every river in the West. And the United States had a proper and good reaction against its former engineering state. But what happened after that was that it overcorrected. A lot of the lawyers who have been running America forever changed in character. They moved away from being creative dealmaker types into regulators and litigators, such that today, if you're going to Harvard Law or Yale Law, your highest calling is still to do some sort of social impact litigation, to sue either the government or the railroad companies to make the trains a little bit slower or something. And so that is the sin of the 1960s, and that's something I hope we can correct today.
Yeah, Robert Moses, we should say, was this sort of pharaoh-like figure in New York, wasn't he? An unelected figure who sort of plowed through neighborhoods with these big infrastructure projects, these massive roads and these massive bridges that we see in New York today. You're listening to ABC Radio National with me, Nick Bryant, and I'm talking with Dan Wong, the author of the New York Times bestseller, Breakneck, China's Quest to Engineer the Future. Dan, when we think of engineering, we think of civil engineering, railways, dams, bridges, but you make the very powerful point that China has also had a lot of social engineering. And that takes us to the dark underbelly of the engineering state. A lot of this social engineering has backfired horribly. Tell us about the one-child policy in China, the classic example of social engineering.
In the year 1980, when the one-child policy was implemented by Beijing, China's leadership had started freaking out about its supposed overpopulation problem. China's population had crossed over a billion people by the year 1980, and the leadership really felt that so many people threatened to overturn all of Deng Xiaoping's efforts to modernize the economy. Into the ears of China's top leadership whispered a very talented mathematician, who was also a missile scientist by the name of Song Jian, who said, well, there's an elegant mathematical solution to overpopulation. It is going to be something so simple as we can call the one-child policy. And this is something that sounds attractive in prospect, that it seems like a mathematically elegant solution. And I understand the one-child policy to have been primarily, as I write in Breakneck, a campaign of rural terror that was visited mostly upon female bodies throughout China's vast countryside, such that throughout the 35 years of the one-child policy, China had conducted, according to its own official numbers, over 300 million abortions over the sterilization of 100 million women, as well as the sterilization of 25 million men. It was a terrible trauma throughout society.
I mean, it's just so hard to get your head around those figures, isn't it? And another more recent example of social engineering, which you experienced firsthand, was COVID. You were living in Shanghai. The portion of your book that talks about your experience there literally gives dystopian literature a run for its money. Tell us what it was like in Shanghai during COVID. Tell us about the drones.
I wish it was only literature that we were living through. Unfortunately, that's when the drones started to descend. And as part of the enforcement of zero COVID, the Shanghai municipal government sent a few drones running around with the loudspeaker saying, "Please repress your souls yearning for freedom," which is an awfully poetic thing for a lot of these civil servants people to say, but that is was one of the messages of repressing your souls yearning for freedom. Over the 3 years of China's zero COVID policy, I think all of us experienced this emotional roller coaster. First, we were all quite mad that China had yet another respiratory virus that was circulating in the South just about 20 years after the circulation of SARS, when they tried to discipline some medical whistleblowers by detaining them and arresting some of them. And yet, it looked like China was managing COVID relatively well, at least with respect to the Americans, with the respect to the Europeans. And so it had the virus under control while getting a lot of the life at the, as well as the economy, back on track. But then there was another leg to this roller coaster, which was that China enforced a pandemic control policy so severe that I described it as the most ambitious lockdown ever attempted in the history of humanity, in which 25 million people living in Shanghai were unable to step foot outside of their homes in the spring of 2022 over the period of about 8 weeks. This is when the food logistics system shut down. This is when a lot of parents decided to go hungry so that their kids could eat. And this is also one of the fundamental features of social engineering.
I think your argument is so fresh and so seductive, but I wonder whether there's another way of looking at America's decline since the end of the Cold War. If you look at the 1990s, America's unipolar moment, sure, you had a lawyer in the White House, Bill Clinton, but in an ideological concession to Reaganism, he pursued a policy of deregulation. He deregulates Wall Street by getting rid of something called the Glass-Steagall Act, which was a New Deal reform to regulate the banks. He decided that the internet and big tech would power the new economy and that government should basically get out of the way. He had a very light touch when it came to regulating the internet. The problem wasn't a surfeit of laws, I suggest, Dan. It was actually not enough regulation. And now America is paying the price for with the financial crash in 2008 and a big tech, which has had such a toxic effect on American life. What do you think of that argument that it wasn't too many lawyers at the turn of the century, it was actually too few?
I think that is a part of America's economic malaise right now, that there has been too many parts of America's economy that arguably deserve quite a lot more regulation. I can certainly endorse that claim. But I think the fundamental flaw of Bill Clinton's administration was not only a spate of deregulation, but it was also a giving in to this neoliberal consensus at the time to fundamentally weaken the government as well. And what we had was an outsourcing of expertise, a lot of contractors that would be much, much better paid than the mass transit officials meant to deliver subways and rail systems in New York. And what I am very interested in correcting is to have this ability for the American state to say that it is going to do something, like build, for example, high-speed rail in California, and that train should arrive, and that train really ought to gleam. Right now, California, which is essentially a one-party state run by the Democrats, really has not delivered any high-speed rail. I strongly suspect that 30 years after the initial referendum by California voters to deliver rail between the cities of San Francisco in the north and Los Angeles in the south, I expect that 30 years later, none of us would be able to take this train. And so I am also interested in making sure that the government has the credibility to do what it says it's going to do, and then it's going to do darn well to actually make it work.
I mean, Bill Clinton famously said, of course, the era of big government is over. Those are words that you could imagine Ronald Reagan saying. I wonder what you make of the presidency of George W. Bush. He didn't go to Harvard Law School. He went to Harvard Business School. And his thinking reflected the orthodoxy of corporate America at that time, which was all about maximizing shareholder value. It was about outsourcing jobs overseas. It was about pushing automation that was wiping out jobs in the Rust Belt. Again, wasn't the problem there that you had somebody who was sort of too doctrinaire from a business mindset rather than a loyalty mindset?
I think that is certainly possible. And let's not forget all of the problems with launching these disastrous wars in the Middle East that we really ought to lay at the feet of George W. Bush, as well as the recently deceased Dick Cheney as well. But I situate George W. Bush as, again, part of this neoliberal consensus that Ronald Reagan perpetuated, Bush's dad perpetuated, and then that flowed, and that pretty naturally to Clinton, Bush, as well as Obama. And we have what we have now is a break from a lot of these traditions. But I would still also say that there are still many ways that the United States works relatively well, that are in a much better place than, I would say, Europe. It is still remarkable that the United States has created not just one company worth over $1 trillion, but several companies worth over several trillions of dollars, mostly clustered around the West Coast of the U.S.
Again, I mean, I wonder where Silicon Valley fits within your thesis. I mean, this is a place that has thrived. This is a place, as you say, that is populated now by these trillion-dollar companies, NVIDIA, Alphabet, Meta, Tesla. Silicon Valley has thrived despite this kind of loyally society.
I think that the United States is the best country in the world where one should be a member of the rich. If you're a member of the rich, you can pretty easily transmute your wealth into some degree of political influence, especially now during the second Trump administration. The rich feel comfortable about building their big businesses in America. And if we are taking a look at somewhere like China, if you're a member of the rich, Xi Jinping is going to come over and smack you around as he did Jack Ma. You can't even get rich in Europe anymore. Most of the wealth in Europe is passed down from one handbag owner to another handbag owner. And so I think that America works really, really well for the rich. This is where you can create these fantastically valued companies. And what I would like is for America to work better for the middle class, people who need affordable homes to live in, people who need mass transit in order to get to work, people who need a thriving manufacturing sector, as well as a more robust defense industrial base as well.
Dan, a final thought. I mean, you speak a lot in the book about the deficiencies of America's manufacturing sector. That could directly impact Australia right now, because one of the areas you focus on is shipbuilding. Every single American naval ship under construction at the moment is behind schedule. And that obviously has an impact with the AUKUS submarine deal. Is America's problems as a loyally society rather than an engineering society actually going to impact Australia when it comes to the delivery of those nuclear submarines?
Quite possibly, yes. And then there is also the political issue of, I think there's been a lot more doubt around the world of whether they want to buy all of this marvelous fighter jet as well as other military equipment from a country that is threatening absolutely everyone. But the disparities in shipbuilding are especially stark. So right now, China has around 1,500 ships under construction. The United States has 5. And so that's a 300-to-1 advantage in favor of China. And this is not; these are not the sort of numbers that make me very comfortable. And so this is where we should all be wondering, you know, whether the U.S. is able to deliver, and even when it is able to deliver, whether it can have the goods. Now, speaking of Australia, I think right before we chatted, I gave you some homework, Nick. I said that the U.S. is the loyally society. The Chinese are the engineering state. I've never been to Australia before. I would love to make it out there. But you have to tell us, what is Australia?
Dan, that is a great question. And let's get you back on the program to talk about it. Before you go, I want to pose the question that I posed in the introduction. Are we already living in the Chinese century? Does China already have a technological edge which is going to see it outstrip the United States over the next couple of decades?
No. I think that the century is still very much up for grabs, that even if China right now has much more manufacturing capacity than the United States, there is plenty of manufacturing capacity around the world, namely from countries like Australia, Canada, where I'm from, where I'm a citizen, Europe, etc., as well as Japan, that technology is not the only measure. There's also things like culture and diplomacy and financial superpowerdom, which the United States possess and the Chinese do not. I think the future is very much up for grabs, that we do not need to submit ourselves too early.
Dan Wong, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much for sharing a great book, which I would urge people to read, Breaknet. Dan Wong, thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much, Nick.
And Dan's book is out next month in Australia. It is fascinating stuff.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music, and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.